Hello everyone, and welcome all of you to Nikki Lyle Creative Presents of Industry Leaders, where today I'm joined by Bill Brock, who's co-founder at Analog Folk. Welcome Bill, thank you so much for joining us today. Would you mind just quickly introducing yourself please, Bill?
Yeah, of course. So my name's Bill Brock. I am founder and now Chief Client Officer, formerly Chief Executive Officer, replaced myself last September for Analog Folk, 12-year-old independent global digital creative agency.
So my first question for you is, at what point in your life did you decide that you wanted to get into the creative industry?
Very good question. So I went to university for architecture, which I lasted all of one semester before realizing I had a love and passion for it, but not a commitment at that age that some of my classmates had. So I took a couple of years in a less creative degree, and then ended my university career with a photography minor. So I went in the US where they have majors and minors, with a photography minor. Unfortunately, it was 1996 and digital photography was just starting. So I spent about three misspent years in dark rooms, which then became obsolete. And I sort of shifted as I left university into the advertising and creative world, and very luckily landed in San Francisco in 1997 at the sort of beginning of the dot-com boom. And really the rest is history. I landed in an amazing little agency called Red Sky. I spent 7 years there before moving over to the UK and was at DDB for a few years before starting Analog Folk.
Yeah, and what made you decide that you wanted to start your own agency?
Starting my own business was something I've always knew that I wanted to do. I actually owned a restaurant when I lived in San Francisco to sort of experiment a little bit in a much more difficult industry on what it takes to start and then run the operations of a business. I guess I just didn't really have the confidence in the industry we're in until I was able to run an office for DDB in the UK. And that sort of gave me the confidence that I understood all the bits of what it takes to run a creative business, from HR and IT through to talent and clients and running P&Ls. But then the spark or the straw that broke the camel's back was being the digital guy, or the guy responsible for evangelizing technology and innovation within an advertising agency. We just found, Matt and I just found ourselves presenting our ideas as part of a broader program of work, always at the end of every deck. So here's the TV ad, here's the print campaign, here's the radio. And there's this funny little idea to do a website, or to do this application, or this using GPS, this interesting product. But we've just sort of thrown it at the end as an afterthought. And it was those moments back in sort of 2006, 2007, where we just said, if we're really going to achieve great innovation for brands, we need to leave the advertising world and start our own business.
Definitely. And so what were the early days of Analog Folk like?
Not glamorous. Not glamorous at all. So I was 32, Matt was 31. So we were far enough in our careers that we had a little bit of a nest egg to live off of. Neither of us had kids. So we had, not dependents that were hoping we brought home a paycheck every night. The first year was really hand to mouth. We didn't steal any clients from our former agency, which in hindsight probably was a mistake. It felt like a really morally sound thing to do at the time. But the first really 15 months was, we did some great work for brands like ASICS and Red Bull and the Science Museum here in London. But it was very project based. And so it kind of felt like we were just freelancers, maybe is a good way to put it, with our own brand. And it wasn't until the second summer when we got invited to pitch for Seat Cars to be their retained digital strategy and creative agency that, and then we won that everything changed. And from then on, we hired, I think, 15 or 16 people, moved from a closet on Elder Street in East London to a what was the Deconstruct, for those of you who are old enough to remember an agency called Deconstruct. It was their office. They moved out when they got bought by Aegis, and we took over their sort of 30 something person office and grew into that. And then, yeah, became something.
Yeah, amazing. I love that. Like, how did you start question? Like, what were the early days like? And then that point, it's the grind, isn't it? And the graft and the start. And then you get some, win some big pitches, some big clients, and then you need to recruit staff to deliver that work. And then off you go.
Off you go. I know this is being recorded, and I think enough time has passed where I can tell stories like this without ramifications. But so the most memorable kind of hand-to-mouth story is that we had an office on Elder Street. If those of you who live in London might know Elder Street, it's just off of Commercial Street near the old Commercial Tavern. It was in a building that actually leaned to the left because the building next to it had fallen over was pretty rough around the edges. And when we started the Seat pitch, there were four of us. The office could fit probably about 12 people. And we didn't kind of take our environment that seriously because our presumption was that the pitch was going to be in Milton Keynes at their office. And on 3 days before the pitch, they called and revealed that they would be coming to our office. And it wasn't great because we were up against AKQA and a couple of other very big agencies who would be like rolling them into these like palatial, beautiful buildings. Our main office had so much damp on one wall that there was actual mold kind of live growing on it. So instead of spending the last 48 hours cramming slides and refining concepts, we spent it building IKEA desks and painting walls and putting up what was a makeshift server room in a closet so that when they came in, we didn't look as pathetic as we would have looked 2 days earlier. And actually then invited, I mean, I know this is a fairly common story, but invited 12 of our closest friends to come in and pretend they worked for us. So when the clients came in, those 14 desks were full of people, but actually only Matt and I and two others actually worked at Analog Folk. The rest were pretending.
Yeah, that's so much like Rosie Lee's story when Nike came to visit and they were in like the bottom of a hairdresser's and they brought in like girlfriends, friends, and everyone just sat at the desk like, yeah, we're designers, we're creators.
Here we are. If you want to stay behind, we can cut your hair as well. yeah, I know, exactly.
And so, I mean, how do you use digital technology to make the world better?
I guess the first thing is designing the agency with a mission in mind from day one, and actually it being the inspiration for the name is probably one of the most important things that we did. And at the time it felt like the right thing to do, but it was way before brands were sort of being purpose-led or putting purpose in the front. And so I think a huge amount of our success has been that mission to use digital to make the analog world better. It has served us so well in how we attract talent, in the client conversations we have in the early days, and in positioning us alongside, from a services perspective, other digital and creative agencies, but with a really unique perspective that, you know, it's not about brand spam and finding new ways to interrupt people, but actually finding ways to create value for them. It's not about designing digital experiences to remove people from the physical world, but rather to enhance it and augment the experience they're having with it. And that narrative has just been more and more right every year, right? And back then it was sort of inspired by the Wii and the fact that Nintendo Wii, you know, had tapped into this incredible sort of experiential physical layer that no video card could compete with. And now it's, you know, all about, you know, how do you use technology for good, and you know, no more prevalent than and or important than in the last couple of months, 3 months, where our lives have all become much more dependent on the internet and much more dependent on it, not only to help us survive and feed ourselves through lockdown, but also to help galvanize voices through Black Lives Matter. And I think, you know, it's that's been really important. And sort of, I guess that's all the background to answer your real question, which is then the other lovely thing about it is it translates itself into lots of different services. You don't need to just say we're a web development company, or we're a content agency, or we're a social media agency, or we're a data or technology development business. We do all those things, and we do all those things in the pursuit of solving those human problems, as opposed to, and business problems, as opposed to just fitting in because we have a particular skill set.
Yeah, and following on from that, with Blackout Tuesday and Black Lives Matter, you actually won a very prestigious award on that day. Could you tell us a bit about that? And
it was surreal because alongside our mission, Matt and I wrote a rather ambitious goal for the company back in 2009. To be regarded as the most innovative creative agency globally. And at the time, people sort of thought we were dreamers. Apologies if you can hear my son crying in the background.
That's, this is the reality of everyone working from home. It's fine.
That's a temper tantrum. There might need to be a 21 person serenade if we can, if you can bursting through that door. But it was quite surreal because we designed this ambition in 2009. We were sort of accused of being kind of dreamers or mad by early employees. Two people in a small office in East London thinking they could win a global innovation award. And to have achieved it in 12 years is great and super proud of that, but to have achieved it and been awarded on the week of Blackout Tuesday and the week where the Black Lives Matter movement was brought back into the forefront of society's sort of minds and eyes was incredible. And, you know, I'm not afraid to admit, a bit frustrating because we couldn't celebrate. I mean, who could, right? How could you think about achievements in a time like that? But at the same time, rather than celebrate, Matt and I got together 6 feet apart, of course, but got together and really actually talked about what should our ambition for the next phase of the journey be? And, you know, if our whole ambition for this first phase has been, I guess, sort of getting on the radar of people around the world and being aware from CMOs to chief digital officers to our counterparts in the industry, if that's what we were aiming for, is being regarded as super innovative and creative, this next stage really surely needs to be about the social impact we want to have, and how do we use that that platform that we've created to do good. So we've spent the last month doing just that. And funny enough, as soon as I get off this, my job is to edit where we've brought together a group of people from around the different offices, from different backgrounds, different ethnic backgrounds, different genders, different sexual orientation within the company, and some clients, to co-create what is going to be that next ambition statement and the building blocks that will help us unlock it. But the thing that will be different about it is that it will be as much about the progressiveness of the work we do as it will be about the impact that has on society.
Yeah, definitely. That's so great to hear it. And I think that purpose is a word that I'm hearing a lot at the moment with designers, creative agencies, social consciousness as well, with all the design and the work that you're creating and the changes that are happening in the world. So I'm very excited to see the next phase of Analog Folk, actually. Oh, so how do you work with your clients? What's your process of how you work with your clients?
So I guess it's there's a lot of it that's quite traditional, right? And there's a lot of it that's very product specific. So for example, in our Australia and Amsterdam offices, Sydney and Amsterdam offices, they lean a little bit more into marketing innovation. So a bit more around using new channels or new technologies to create new experiences for prospects and consumers at a wider sense versus customer experiences in terms of products and services. Where in London and New York, we do a little bit more of that and a balance of the two. And obviously but Hong Kong and Shanghai, we do almost exclusively products and services. So it's a little bit different from market to market and from client to client. But I guess the common thread is that we talk, we start with the strategic conversation first, and we don't have any clients with whom we work as just a production or creative partner. It's all long-term strategic partnership, where the first job is to really deeply understand the audiences and consumers with whom they are trying to create new value and what that new value can look like, whether that's an augmentation of an existing product or service that they offer, or whether that's using digital to create new products, new services, or just support the ecosystem that they already have with content that is a bit more engaging than being brand centric, but rather being more audience centric. Mm-hmm. I know I'm aware I bounced around a bit with the answer, but I think in summary, it's quite different from brief to brief. But the common thread that goes through all of it is that the first part of our process is a strategic one, and it's really understanding what success looks like, but for both the brand and the audience we're talking to, not just for the brand.
Yeah, and you've got quite a few offices as well all around the world. Was that always the vision for you and Matt, that you were going to be a global company? Organically.
So I got caught out. I think we were about 12 or 18 months in, and we were still in that two guys in a closet stage, that's for sure. And I ended up being interviewed for something in Campaign magazine, and I said something, I tend to have a bit loose lips, and I said something that ended up being the headline, which is, I won't remember it exactly, but it was something like Analog Folk pledges to go global within 5 years or something like that. And I think what I had said was that our ambition was to be the most innovative agency, be regarded as the most innovative creative agency in the world. That didn't mean that, we necessarily need to be geographically everywhere, but I think it got sort of twisted maybe a little bit. But I'm glad that it did, because it put a fire in my belly to not be to make sure that becomes a reality. We haven't expanded because of opportunism. We haven't expanded specifically because we want to travel to Sydney or New York or Portland or Amsterdam or wherever it is we've got offices. We've expanded predominantly in the service of clients, and so Portland obviously because of the amount of work we do with Nike, Amsterdam because of the volume of work we do with Diageo and particularly Johnny Walker, and obviously Nike's got their European headquarters there as well. Hong Kong and Shanghai has been predominantly built on our 10-year relationship with HSBC, and they do most of their mobile development out of Hong Kong versus they do a lot of their brand development in London. So having a presence in both those cities is quite important to work with them on the bigger platform projects. But it has been great, and it's created a complexity in our business, which sometimes has been challenging to overcome. Geopolitical issues, economic issues that are very different in different markets, cultural challenges around. We're very culture-driven business where our folk are really the center of the business, and we do a lot in terms of our employee experience and being able to translate that in from New York to Hong Kong to Sydney to a very, very different. So it has been challenging, but I would say the things that have been fantastic about it, I guess one unselfish and one selfish. The unselfish one is that it means we can credibly talk to global clients about the challenges of being multicultural. If you're a consultancy consulting with the biggest brands in the world, the Coca-Cola's, Unilever's, Diageo's, Nike's, HSBC's, and you're a bunch of people sat in East London, I think it's not that credible. Like, what do you really know about what banking is like in China or what banking is like in America if you're a bunch of English people in East London? I think it's not that credible. Whereas we are able to very quickly draw on insights, experience, and knowledge from, not all around the world. We don't have any offices in Latin America or Africa as of yet, but from a lot of the key markets where our clients operate pretty quickly. Selfishly, I love to travel. I've spent most of my life, I grew up in Canada and then in the US, lived here for 17 years. But in the last 10 years, I've spent 4 of them in our other offices. And so being able to spend 8 months in Shanghai, 9 months back in New York when my son was born was quite nice for his grandparents, being able to be in Australia for 3 months, being in Amsterdam last year for a couple of months. So selfishly, it's kept me super interested.
Mm. And that's such a good point about like the impressive roster of clients that you work with and the fact that you have a global presence and that you can draw in all the different cultural influences, and that understanding definitely makes a lot of sense. So you talk a lot about the people that make up Analog Folk and the work culture, and could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, sure. So we're not a freelance dependent business. So across the 7 sort of main offices, we've got about 200 and anywhere between sort of 220 and 250 permanent staff, and then we typically might have another 30 or 40 freelancers, and we've also got a joint venture in Bulgaria that does more long tail development, that's maybe another 30 or 40 people. But across all of that, there is a common set of so that's one challenge. There's a lot of people, and it's a young culture. So turnover, even as wonderful an experience as we can create, turnover just naturally happens when you're inviting 22, 23, 24 year olds to start their career somewhere. When they get to be 27, 28, 29, they just want to try something else, whether they're having the time of their life or not. And we've always been very open about encouraging people to have that experience. If we don't have an office somewhere where they can move, then they should go and do it with someone else, so they could see different parts of the world. Or if they want an experience at a bigger network agency because they want to see what it's like, or a smaller, even younger agency, we never discourage that. I think it's important to, be open in that way. We've got people from all different skill sets and backgrounds, whether that's a technology team, strategy team, and creative and data teams. If I take those 4, you're typically talking about very different personalities, different ages, different levels of experience, And so that diversity in skill set, and then you layer on top of it a very strong and passionate diversity and inclusion strategy in terms of gender and sexual orientation and ethnic origin as well, means that it's super important to have like a center of gravity for people and to understand the mission that we're all on, to use digital to make the NL grow better, but also the values that we share. So we, alongside the ambition and the mission, the third big part of the sort of foundation of the company since day one has been a core set of five values. So they are, and I'll have to remember them off the top of my head, they are to make things. So first and foremost, we are a creative business. It's about making stuff that lands in front of consumers and users. Let's not live our life in PowerPoint. To be remarkable, meaning every day bring something that is worthy of remark to your job, whether that's going out of your way to help someone who looks like they're snowed under, try out a new technology that or learn something new you've never experienced before, or have a conversation with a client that helps push their thinking in a new way. Do something remarkable each day. Find a way, which is problem solving, which any technology business, that is part and parcel. If you're not able to sort of bob and weave when technology lets you down or shows you a limitation, you're not going to do anything innovative. Fail brilliantly, which is one that when we wrote it felt quite individual and unique. We've seen it come up a lot over the last decade. Again, it's a really important part of digital culture because it is about testing and learning and being nimble and agile with how you build things and the experiences you create. And then the last one is be nice. And I wrote originally underneath that one, there's no room for assholes. And apparently over the years, as we've gotten bigger, HR has told me I'm not allowed to say that. So we just now say there's no room for egos. But I still like the original writing myself. And that's just, again, it's obvious, but, at the end of the day, we welcome a lot of young people into their first careers. We hope people stay with us for a long time. We recognize that we're in an industry where people, tend to put in long hours sometimes. There's absolutely no reason why you should have to put up with, colleagues, teammates, who bring their ego with them to work and therefore put their colleagues into smaller boxes and force them to navigate difficult situations. So we are considering a sixth one, which I won't tell you guys, unfortunately, today, but as part of this next stage ambition, I think we'll probably add one more. If you were listening before, you can probably guess what it will be, but there you go.
I always say that's the main thing clients say, no egos. Like, you're not Kanye West, joining an agency. You're an individual that's part of a bigger picture of a creative team and making sure that you can get on with everyone and add value. And it's so damaging to a business when you do hire someone that, like you say, is an arsehole. It's so toxic. It just affects the whole dynamic and the work as well.
We haven't been perfect. I'll tell you that there have been a few that have come through the doors over 12 years, but I think the thing I'm most proud of with the culture is that they're not here anymore and we didn't have to kick them out. The culture itself sort of spat them out, if mm-hmm. you will. The sort of the analog folk mob made them realize, look in the mirror, that maybe this isn't the right place for them.
Good. And so how have you been affected by the pandemic? And have you found that being a global company has made you a bit more robust?
Being diversified has. So amazingly, our Asia Pacific businesses have been having the best year that they've had in a long time in 2020. So both our Asia business and the office in Australia have had an absolutely cracking 2020. Partly that's down to their slightly smaller. And so a big win or a couple of big wins makes a big difference in their numbers. But it's also that part of the world has just dealt with it, that the pandemic, much more effectively than the rest of us. And so we haven't seen as much business disruption there. The Europe, I mean, we're all living it. So we all know the challenges we're having here. And the US, our New York office in particular, is in the middle of, you know, the epicenter, or what has been the epicenter in the US. So the diversity of that has helped geographically, but also we're not dependent on any individual client. So across our portfolio of clients, no single client is responsible for more than 15% of our global revenue. We are diversified in terms of, you know, Nike and the sportswear business has actually been quite bullish through the pandemic. HSBC and the banking industry has been less bullish. FMCG companies like Unilever and L'Oreal have tended to have really strong early pandemics because people bought twice what they usually bought one of. They're now going through maybe a bit of a soft spot or a lull. Coca-Cola is another client as well that's had some of those lulls happening. But then on the flip side, we do work with Diageo, with Eve Sleep here in the UK, and increasingly the realization that their digital ecosystem is not fit for purpose, and the opportunism that comes with a direct-to-consumer proposition. We're seeing we've started 5 new projects in the last 2 months that are all with that same brief. Basically, we need to remove the retailer from our journey and go direct to consumer more frequently, and digital is the primary channel we're going to do that in. So we were lucky. So in summary, we don't have any big travel or tourism clients. That's good. We have diversity of geography, diversity of clients. We're in a good part of the business in terms of digital transformation being something everyone is now even more aware that they're behind in doing. We had a fantastic Q1 in almost all of our offices, which helps because that pipeline feeds the next 3 months. So our H1, our first half of the year, will be not as amazing as we had hoped coming out of February, but still around the same level as we achieved last year, which is a success. And then H2, I think Q3 is going to be probably difficult, maybe a little bit more difficult than Q2 was because of that sort of delay of clients all being distracted for April and May. That's usually the planning cycle that projects then start in July and August. So I think we'll have a bit of a soft summer, but then I'm expecting, and we're seeing, a very strong September, October, November, because again, clients will start to realize and those plans will have been put in place that they need to pivot more quickly.
Yeah, definitely. That's so interesting, the fact that I've found that any agency out there that has bread and butter clients that are just like one or two and they can be affected by something like this pandemic, they're really struggling and they've had to, like, you know, panic furlough loads of staff, and then some work might trickle through and then they're like, oh God, do we get some freelancers in, etc. Have you had to furlough any staff? Do you mind me asking?
No, that's okay. We have, but very a very small amount. So we didn't furlough anyone in the first rounds anywhere in the world. And then in early June, I guess it was the deadline, end of May or beginning of June, first week or so of June, for the second phase of furlough that runs through October. We have furloughed, I think it's 8, maybe 10 people in our UK office. So, but that, it sounds like a lot, but we're 140 people, so it's actually quite a small amount. Yes. Though they've been about a balance of two things: office services, sadly, right? I mean, we're not in the office. We haven't been in since, like everyone else, middle of March. We thought we would go back in September, so we were keeping those guys gainfully employed and keeping them busy doing sort of runners tasks and other things. But it now looks like we probably won't go back this year. I think we'll go back in January. So that just made sense to do. And actually, from their perspective, giving them the time to pursue hobbies and the other interests. And we've got a few of those people who are actually training to come through the ops roles into our core production business. And so giving them the time to do that training has been, I think, really beneficial for them. And then we've had a few people in just more of the typically freelanced roles in design production and stuff like that, where we're just not seeing the volumes we saw before.
Mm-hmm. And how have you found people working from home has affected the quality of the output of the work?
It's a very complex question, as simple as it sounds, because I think it really is role dependent. I'd say on the sort of enlightening side, I have always been a office culture person, and I think that I finally was woken up to the fact that maybe I'm a bit old, and my sort of like fervent belief that the culture of having 100 people in a beautifully designed space with company meetings every Friday and a pub night on Friday evening and breakfast on Monday mornings together, and you know, those, that sort of being together, a social aspect, is so ingrained and important. I've been proven wrong, I guess, on a lot of levels, that people have taken to socializing with colleagues through Zoom pretty easily and pretty readily. And so the sort of culture of collaboration has been more resilient than I expected. The productivity has actually, I think, gone up. Like, I actually think people aren't commuting for 2 hours a day. They're not distracted by hallway conversations or music or noise. They're on time to meetings more than they ever were, right? Like, turn Zoom on and there you are. You don't have to wait for the previous team to come out of the meeting room. So I actually think I would say that the productivity side has benefited a little bit. The creativity, I think, is where it's hit and miss. I think our output has been as good ultimately, but the process of getting there, collaborating as creative teams, I mean, designers, I know a lot of people on this call are designers, just the organic nature of all sitting on the same floor, being able to look over each other's shoulders, get a little bit of advice on whether something looks the way that it should, or there's a way to maybe make it look or feel better. That sort of organic peer-to-peer feedback, I think people are missing. I know people are missing that a lot. So I think that'd be the one big, and again, probably mostly it's design, mostly design and creative that are having the hardest time. Writers, technologists, strategists, not having the project manager over your shoulder tapping on your shoulder every hour to see how you're getting on. I think they've really thrived in that.
Mm-hmm. I think as well, like I've had a few freelancers help me out with some graphics, and it's just all slack, slack, slack all the time, and you almost have to manage things like using that, where, as you say, people aren't used to just saying, hey, come over here, have a look at this on my screen, how does it look? Will you be hiring, do you think, or over the next couple of weeks or months, or are you just going to keep the core team as it is?
I think probably I'm not as close to that anymore. Our office MDs and their plans were not much for command and control, so there's a lot of autonomy in our offices to make those decisions. They decide, those things tend to ebb and flow pretty frequently this year, whereas in previous years, the sort of hiring plan or the conditional hiring plan would be established at the beginning of the year, and then you'd, you know, sort of slightly evolve it depending upon ups and downs in revenue and shape of work. This year, every month, it's like, well, what's happening now? Which clients are, you know, doubling down on their spend, which are pulling back or pausing things? I would say we are significantly less freelance dependent this year than any other year, because obviously the volume of work is less consistent, and therefore this sort of like last minute, we've got a project that needs to start tomorrow, they tend to be a little bit less of that now. More considered spending from clients. So our volume of freelancers in every office is way down, which means that we've got space. If we think about it as a sort of freelance as a bit of a buffer for when volume goes up and down, I always like that to be somewhere between sort of 10 and 15% of our overall employment costs. Then if some work drops out, you just cut freelancers, and if more work comes in, you might prop it up and then start hiring underneath. I think the reality is we're maybe 5% right now. So I think the more likely scenario is if work picks up, that we will freelance in July, August, September, and then come October and going into Q4, hopefully if the our society here and in other countries continues to improve, then we don't have any bounce backs, we'll start to see clients spend with more confidence. And then at that point, I think we would probably, you know, obviously look to bring in permanent staff versus freelance.
Yeah. And will you be taking on any interns, do you think, this year? Okay, so is any juniors watching?
Yeah, so we have an intern program in most of our offices. The biggest one is in the UK. Sharif is the name of our head of recruitment. You can find him on LinkedIn. He's the right person to go and talk to. We do tend to our work placement, intern, and recruitment policies overall are quite progressive, in the sense that we are trying to seek to find people coming from quite diverse backgrounds. So we did a long-term partnership that came to a close last year with the Roundhouse, where we taught a lot of courses to get people from underserved communities into technology and creative industry. And we've had a lot of those people come and be successful in the company since. Fresh AF, which is our intern program, will run this year, and it will have that diversity to it. So there'll be some, everyone's obviously open to apply. We'll seek out people to join that from all sorts of backgrounds. I don't know, so don't, when you go to Sharif, don't say Bill said there's a program this year and it's live. I'm not sure the status of it, to be honest, because obviously having an intern program when everyone's working remotely is quite challenging in terms of mentorship. I know that we're doing it, I just don't know whether the format has maybe been slightly adjusted during remote working.
Yeah, it's incredible that you do that at Analog Folk, actually, like your collaboration over at the Roundhouse and all the courses that you run and all the diversity. It's amazing. But I think that's all my questions, really. So shall we allow people to ask their own questions? So if you just want to pop those into the Q&A box, guys, and we'll get over to those. Okay, so first one is, what advice would you give to a senior designer with the drive to transition into a more lead role?
Good question. I think I always see, and I'm not our head of design, nor have I ever been, But I always think that the sort of difference between being a junior or midweight designer to being a senior designer is a lot about how you nurture and lead the creative product, and how you then build confidence and skills in the team around you. The move from senior to lead, the biggest thing I'd say is the confidence to present your work and to present it to quite senior clients. So my advice would be, depending upon how confident you are naturally, would be to practice that as much as possible. Take every opportunity you have to champion your own work in front of senior teams within your agency, but then also finding every opportunity to present directly to clients, to hear the feedback directly, to be a really good, empathetic listener, and, you know, fight for your work, but also understand that the people that are judging it and buying it, their points of view, whilst it doesn't typically come from an art school background, is often extremely valid, right? That they have a level of experience and understanding of their business, of their consumers, of their audience, that is, you know, that is to be really valued. And so listening is a really big important part of leading versus just seniority. Yeah, that'd be my main advice, I guess.
Yeah, that's really good advice. I guess the main thing is showing, it's in the title, that you can lead as a creative lead and pushing your own ideas. And it is that next level, isn't it, from just a senior. So, okay, at the start of setting up Analog Folk, did you find it tough to find clients? Was it mainly through word of mouth?
Yes, it was. So I'm trying to remember. So there were a few that came from Matt and my reputation. I use that in that word sort of loosely, from the experience we had and clients that we had worked with who had left and gone to other organizations. There was, my job is sales, so there was a heavy dose of just getting on the phone and speaking to as many people who knew people who knew people. The amazing thing that I think most people find when they set up a business is that there are there's a whole community of people that want to see you succeed. And the most important thing is to be quite vulnerable in that world and be willing to ask for help. And, you know, so going and calling former clients and saying, you know, I see that you're connected on LinkedIn to so-and-so, how well do you know them? Would you be willing to give me a warm introduction? I grew up in New York, and I've always thought that that's a little bit of an advantage coming over here, because cold calling and salesmanship in America is an art form. Here, it's a little bit more of, there's sort of more taboo associated with it. And I think people, ultimately clients, like to learn about new creative companies, new processes, new methods, new ways of working. And so being unashamed to promote yourself and do it in a, you know, I guess a more cold call oriented way, a way that a lot of people would think is bottom feeding, is not something to be ashamed of. So yes, I in short, a few clients through word of mouth, a few through word of mouth, and then eventually we had case studies that we could go and talk about.
I think in regards to like business development, some of it for me is like referrals, recommendations, but also just reaching out to people. Like the worst thing someone's going to say is no, or you might catch them when they're busy and say, oh, when's a better time to call you? And if people believe in your business and what you're doing and they're interested in it, they'll be quite surprisingly helpful, I've found.
Yeah, I agree.
So someone said, it's interesting to hear that you changed direction after studying. What portfolio pointers would you have for junior designers looking to move into digital? Do you look at portfolios much?
I look at them less every year, because time is I don't have loads of it, and we've got an incredible network of creative talent, creative directors, design directors, etc., who spend more of their time doing that. I would say that from a just general portfolio perspective, and this is obviously coming from a digital agency, right? So if you're going to more of a integrated or a traditional creative business, this may not apply. But when it comes to what we would look for, new channels, new platforms, new and interesting ways to stretch the mediums that we work in. And this I cannot understate, and you probably, if you do this, you might find that you're underwhelmed by the reaction from some people, but you probably don't want to go work for them anyway. Understanding the impact of your work and being able to talk about that, not just look at this cool thing I did and isn't it great and doesn't it look beautiful and it's on TikTok and isn't it interesting. That's all good and that's important. And, you know, being able to tell the narrative from brief to concept to execution, but also being as passionate about the results, like, and not just, hey, it got 300,000 views or it got great comments, but actually, if you are working for an agency currently that has a good measurement and analytics team, like, go and talk to them about how your work is performing and bring that back into your portfolio, because clients are becoming more and more, you know, obviously digital opens up a whole new world of accountability, and clients are interested in working with creatives who understand how you tie work back to business success.
Mm. And so what advice would you give, so is that main thing, for like someone that's a junior looking to like move into digital?
I would say use your spare time to experiment and play with formats. I would say be as best you can a Swiss Army knife, because things, you know, I used to say this to developers, like, if you're a PHP developer, you better learn two or three other languages or become tech agnostic and think about architecture and infrastructure, because the industry is going to do that at least five times while you're in it. And so that's now equally relevant to designers, and, you know, understanding motion, being able to think about CGI and 3D, being able to design for VR, AR, MR. Those are all skill sets that increasingly you'll have to have. And we try and hire designers who have an incredible visual skill set, but we more often than not hire ones who also are able to do two or three of the things I just mentioned.
Yeah. I mean, if anyone at the moment is looking to upskill, what area do you think there's a shortage of where they should look into upskilling in, perhaps?
I think motion is probably the one where there's going to be the most volume of work in the next 5 years. I think everyone can talk about VR and AR and CGI and all of that, but I don't think there'll be a volume of it. I think it's a great place to be because it will increase, but it won't increase, I don't think, at as much scale as motion design. And I think it makes you fantastic, especially at junior levels, it makes you fantastically valuable in an agency. Because, you know, everything from I've got a client presentation tomorrow and I want to bring this concept to life on a slide, through to we've got to do a case study video of this project for an RFI by Thursday, through to we've got this really interesting video project for Coca-Cola, and we want to, you know, bring to life all of this existing assets, or we want to do a bespoke shoot, all of those things. Those are, you know, that's ranging from sort of deeply internal value through to deeply external client value. You just make yourself much more valuable.
Yeah, I fully agree with you there. So anyone watching this needs to develop more motion skills if you have a chance, and that will give you a real competitive edge. But I'm very mindful that you're going to have to go, Bill. So I'm going to wrap this up here. But again, thank you so much for spending your time with us today. It's been a really good talk with loads of insight. And I'm sure I've had loads of comments popping up from everyone else that's been enjoying the talk. So thanks to everyone that's joined us today.
Nice to meet you guys. Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.